You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Well, it's been nearly 6 months of delving into the themes of A Conspiracy of Love. And today I'm thrilled to have its author, Kurt Struckmeyer, as our guest. Along with Kurt himself having joined me for a Zoom conversation earlier this week, virtually all of the liturgy today, from the call to celebration and unison act of awareness to the offering song, have been adapted from Kurt's writings. I think you'll agree that Kurt has provided us with an abundance of insights and resources to fuel our efforts to follow Jesus. But before we get to that, let me say just a few words about our words of wisdom today. Jesus has just reiterated with his disciples what following him is going to look like. And it goes beyond just loving our neighbor as ourself, all the way to loving our enemies. Listen, and you'll hear Jesus say, look, God extends grace even to ungrateful and evil people. And if you want to follow me, you have to strive for that kind of compassion, that kind of mercy too. It's a tall order, but that's what we've been talking about all these months in considering participation in Jesus' conspiracy of love. Ultimately, the gospel about Jesus is a self-centered undertaking, benefiting oneself and one's own interests. The gospel of Jesus, on the other hand, is self-giving, forgiving, inclusive, and compassionate, even in the face of adversity, and even for the benefit of our enemies. It's about throwing one's lot in with the poor and the disenfranchised, just like Jesus did. So, as we continue to wrestle with the implications of participating in Jesus' conspiracy of love, let's hear from Jesus himself one more time as he lays out some of the core values of what the gospel of Jesus really needs to look like as we head into the future.
Our words of wisdom are from Luke 6, verses 32 through 36.
Jesus said, "If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again.
But love your enemies, do good, and lend, expecting nothing in return. Your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be compassionate, just as your Father is compassionate."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Hey, everybody. This is David Felton here from Fountains United Methodist, and I'm thrilled to be here with Kurt Struckmeyer today, author of A Conspiracy of Love, which we have been studying and doing a sermon series on for the last nearly 6 months. So, Kurt, great to be with you live from Michigan.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
As I've said before, I've been so grateful for your book, which has been so clarifying of a lot of the ideas that I talk about regularly in my sermons anyway. And you've brought a particular spin to it and a particular way of saying it that anyone can understand. And that has been so helpful to me and my congregation. So it's great to have you here to be in conversation today.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your story and how did you get from the GM design studio to becoming the oracle of the gospel of Jesus?
Well, theology and art were the two halves of my personality all my life. And I went to School of Fine Arts. I studied drawing, painting, and sculpture. And in my sophomore and senior year, I majored in sculpture. I was wondering what I was going to do with my life for a job that didn't have the have me saying, "You want fries with that?" So I remembered that in my junior year, a group came from GM recruiting sculptors to be clay modelers. So I called them. I sent them my portfolio. They called me up for an interview, and I went in. And as somebody explained, you know, a bus pulls up, the doors open, I got on, and didn't get off for 36 years. But I did varied jobs in design center. I was a clay modeler for 7 years. I was a technician. I operated some of the earliest NC equipment and computer equipment around. And then I did planning, and I wound up writing speeches for the vice president by the time I retired. That was all well and good, but starting in the 70s, I was reading lots of theology. I remember reading William Stringfellow, and I was studying the prophets, and I was studying the words of Jesus. And all of those things made me call into question a lot of stuff.
And you grew up Lutheran?
I grew up Lutheran, yep. Missouri Synod Lutheran.
Ah,
for the first
very particular flavor, yes.
Yeah, for the my youth, and then ELCA as an adult. Then in the mid-80s, they started doing historical Jesus research, and that was fascinating. And I read Borg and Crossan. I read Richard Horsley, Walter Wink, and many other authors. They all kept deconstructing things. They kept tearing apart, you know, my childhood faith. I began taking copious notes, writing things down. And for things that they said, I quote them. And eventually, you know, that added up into a mass manuscript that was about that thick. I created a website out of it and other things.
And that's followingjesus.org?
Yes. And then I sent the manuscript off to Whip and Stock Publishers, who are about the only place that's receives unsolicited manuscripts.
Right.
And they got back to me and they said, "This is great stuff. But it's too long. It's the equivalent of three books." So they said, "Why don't you divide it up into thirds, and each with a slightly different topic?" And I said, "Sure, that sounds like a good idea." So A Conspiracy of Love was the first one. And it was mostly focused on Jesus and his message.
Tell me about where your background in art and your approach to creativity has enhanced your thinking about theology and about moving from deconstruction to creating something new.
You know, art is really bringing order out of chaos. And so I was trying to bring some order to the whole thing. And so when I was reading the authors who deconstructed things for me, I began to try and say, well, what remains of this faith that we all believe in? And so I began searching for ways to put a positive spin on it. And I wound up with this handful of sayings that is left from Jesus, you know, that are, or as far as we can tell, are historically accurate. So
right, yeah. Well, and I mean, I think, you know, one of my mentors, Brandon Scott, calls the Beatitudes Jesus' stump speech. Yeah. You know, that, I mean, that's really kind of the core of what Jesus talked about. And if we can use that, we've got a lifetime worth of work ahead of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I so appreciate the way you have brought together so many of the things that I've talked about into clear sayings, like the difference between the gospel of Jesus and the gospel about Jesus, to separate the ways that we approach Christianity in this 21st century Western world. There's another aspect of your work that I wanted to ask you about, namely that being grounded in the assumption that we are living in a postmodern world. What does postmodern mean? And how is the faith that most of us grew up with necessarily different because we are in a postmodern world? What is postmodern?
Well, there were probably three major historical periods. There was pre-modern, there was modern, and postmodern. And the pre-modern world grew up in the alliance of the temple and the state. The priestly class amplified what the ruling class said.
Right.
And they lent authority to the words. So that in the pre-modern world, people accepted anything you told them, you know, basically. Then the modern world began around, in the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
And the Renaissance.
Yep. Out of which Lutheranism and the Methodist movement grew. Yeah. We're products of the modern world.
Yes, we are. Although our faith is still rooted
pre-modern.
Yeah. In the modern age, which began in the Renaissance, we began to search for the truth. The scientific method was employed. Writers in the 18th century, like Thomas Jefferson, tried to sort out what was true about the Bible and what wasn't. And he wrote the Jefferson Bible by cutting up all the pieces that he didn't agree with.
Right.
And the postmodern people are basically disenchanted modernists. They have found that, you know, religion doesn't provide all the answers to our life. And the modern age brought about technology that was a boon, like medicine, and a disaster, like the nuclear bomb. And I think the postmodern age probably began around 1945 with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the realization then that we were living, you know, in an intolerable situation.
Our technology has kind of gotten ahead of our ability to think it through.
Yeah, so postmodernists are not, they don't believe in facts because facts can be culturally construed. They're always, cultures are different in their approach to truths, you know?
Give me an example, Kurt.
Well, postmodern people really don't care about answering pre-modern questions like, did Jesus really rise from the dead? Was Mary really a virgin? And all that. They want to know why the church is intolerant of gays, you know, endorses violence, puts down women. As we get into the postmodern world, it's really affecting the church. We've never faced anything like this before.
Yeah, you think about, you know, we United Methodists, and it's in the news this summer, the Southern Baptist Convention is cracking up or melting down, and the Roman Catholic Church has been facing its comeuppance with its failure to deal with the sexual abuse within their ranks. And all these formerly authoritative and relevant institutions are passing into irrelevance, and I would say benign irrelevance, but they're not really benign. They are actually doing harm. So
yeah.
So what's your take on how we're going to deal with that, or where we can go?
It's a case of postmodernity facing the church. The churches are going to have to get used to getting smaller, getting grayer and smaller, because there's nobody else young out there that's joining. What's the future of the church? And that's the subject of my third book, but I don't know yet.
Yeah, that'll be good if you can tell us.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found to be true working over the years with Living the Questions is the material that we've put out and that I preach at the Fountains and elsewhere really doesn't resonate with most people until they've hit 50 plus years old.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's just something about our spiritual development as human beings that doesn't bring us to a point where we're prepared to think the kind of way that you've presented in A Conspiracy of Love, or that I often present through the Living the Questions material for young people. It's like we have to live through a certain amount of life before we stop and say, hang on, but what does this really mean?
Yeah.
What's your take on that?
I see that young people today are just so busy getting on with their lives. Their children are signed up for sports and camps and everything, and they're busy running around all the time. And it really is a question of, you know, getting older, as you said. Yeah, I don't think that people are really focused on meaning, the meaning of life, until maybe our age.
I think the future of whatever following Jesus is going to look like is necessarily, as you say, going to be smaller, more small group based, less institutional as we recognize it today, and much more responsive to the real needs of real people, rather than trying to convince people of doctrinal truths or having to come on board with certain belief systems.
Yeah.
Orthopraxy, and as opposed to orthodoxy, you know, living the right way as opposed to believing the right way or believing the things that we were taught.
That's what Jesus was all about.
Yeah.
And the church has chosen instead to focus on believing stuff about Jesus rather than saying, hey, Jesus called for radical change in the world.
And maybe people aren't ready for radical change, you know?
I mean, I think that's what I appreciate so much from A Conspiracy of Love, is that you keep saying over and over again, we've got to get out of our comfort zone. We've got to be engaged with what's really going on the margins, and with the people who live on the margins, if we're genuinely going to do what Jesus has asked us to do.
That's right. That's right.
If there's one thing that you'd want people to know who have survived nearly 6 months of me blathering on about A Conspiracy of Love, what would it be? What would you want to say to people who are now exposed to that and want to make something of that in their lives?
It's important to remember that Jesus calls you to do something. It doesn't have to be big things. Many small acts will eventually change the world. And I think we should take heart in that. You know, I think we should be encouraged by that. The challenge that we're facing is to embrace the conspiracy of love and to become ardent lovers who will share that. You know, as I worry about the church getting smaller and smaller and maybe going away, we still need those ardent lovers who are sharing that. So join the conspiracy.
Because that's the only way we're going to be able to genuinely pass on the message to the next generation.
Yeah.
Is to see it in action.
Yeah.
Kurt, thank you so much. I'm so grateful for your writings, both your books and your website. And as I think people may recognize in our service today, virtually everything in the service is taken from your writings, which have been a great inspiration to me. And I'm so grateful for your work. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, David.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.